Well, we've been doing this new podcast for a while now, and haven't we had a lot of feedback?
Yes, just a bit.
People have been getting in touch all over the place. I was astounded by how much people are using the web form on our website.
In 2023?
I know, yeah. Lots of email, lots of toots on Mastodon as well. So, yeah, let's have a look at some of the things people have been saying. I mean, firstly, I think we just need to say thank you to all of the lovely comments that we got from people who were just, you know, happy to have us back, as we're happy to be back. So thank you to everyone who sent their love.
Yes, that was nice.
It was indeed.
We had a few people get in contact about our show notes. David emailed to say that he wanted to check out the websites of other shows but couldn't find them. Now, I think Joe is planning to add a site to latenightlinux.com with all of the shows in the Late Night Linux family so that they're easier to find. And Tom and Connor emailed about links in our show notes to things that we were talking about. That was a bit of an oversight on our part. We are trying to make sure that we add links to the things that we discuss. So hopefully we'll rectify those in the future.
I went overboard in episode 12. Every other word was a link.
Yeah, I think up to this point, we've linked to like top level projects that we've discussed. We've tried to keep our show notes lean. We're going for Six Sigma black belt status with podcast production here. But we also often write blog posts that supplement the episode. So some of those links are like full exposés. And Alan, you've been doing loads of blogs and stuff now. I think you've done more blogs to supplement the podcast than anyone.
Yeah.
Probably more than podcasts.
Yes. Sorry about that.
Mark, we had a stack of feedback about your journey or starting your journey with TPM and Lux. So Alex emailed us and they said that they agreed they'd found setting up TPM to be rather finicky. But one thing that they did suggest is taking a look at unlocking Lux with a YubiKey or similar.
Yeah, I had this suggestion from a ton of people. So the idea here is that you have a YubiKey, which is a separate USB device designed for storing things like encryption keys. So you have that plugged in when you boot and you press a button or scan a thumbprint or something. And then that basically types your password in as a pretend keyboard. And then you can take it out and store it separately when you're not booting. And that means that if your laptop gets nicked and they don't have the YubiKey, they can't then get into it. So that seems like a pretty neat suggestion for not having to type in a long password while still maintaining quite a lot of security. One thing I didn't have from anyone, which I was hoping for, was I didn't have anyone either say that unlocking with a TPM and is still secure because, and I also didn't have anyone say it's definitely not secure because. I was hoping that someone would show me the exploit, which means you definitely shouldn't do this. There was one reported whereby you can, basically, if you mash the keyboard at the passphrase prompt, it causes it to drop to a root shell in the initram fs, and because at that point the boot state is in the state that the TPM is expecting, you can then get the TPM to give you the password. So
wow,
that's not ideal. But one thing which happened not long after we published was that Ubuntu had a big announcement that they're adding support for this very setup in Ubuntu from 23.10 onwards. And the blog post about that and the Ubuntu security podcast that came out in conjunction with that go into quite a lot of detail. They're well worth a listen, but they did enlighten me to a few things, in particular, a use case for this. And in fact, the reason that they were working on it in Ubuntu in the first place was that it lets you enable full disk encryption on unattended and headless systems much more easily, because you might have an IoT device or a headless server somewhere where you don't have it connected to a keyboard and a monitor, and you don't have someone there to enter a password, but you might still be worried that someone's going to walk into your server rack and pull out the hard drive and wander off. So this actually allows you to benefit from full disk encryption in those scenarios.
So that's interesting, because you talked about using the YubiKey, and Simon emailed to describe that setup as well. And now you're talking about like unattended systems. And we had a couple of emails, one from Alan, who was using some software called Tang to do sort of network authenticated decryption. And then Manuel was using an SSH session into the sort of pre-boot session of the device in order to unlock it over SSH, and just using a thumb drive with some sort of secret on it as the unlock mechanism, so it won't decrypt at boot without the thumb drive being inserted.
Yeah, the SSH session seems a bit hairy to me, but I do like the idea that of having a remote key server that can deliver your key at boot time, and then if your laptop gets stolen, you could revoke that key and it won't be delivered. The downside, of course, being that you then have to be online to be able to access it.
I quite like the idea of the boot process being made as convoluted as possible, so that, you know, it'll only boot on a Tuesday, and if the webcam is turned on and you're holding a banana and winking at the same time, like, who would spot that? You know, whenever you see the Edward Snowden documentaries and he throws a blanket over his head while he's unlocking his computer so that you can't see what's going on. I reckon he's got a banana under there and holding it up to the webcam. That's all it is. That's my idea for unlock anyway.
So was there anything else you learned from the feedback on TPM and Lux?
I think one other good thing from the Ubuntu blog post is that to get around that issue that I described, whereby you can basically interrupt the boot process at a point where the TPM is happy to deliver the passphrase, the way that Ubuntu are implementing this are they're using a snap which contains both the kernel and a signed in it RAM disk, which makes that part of the process more secure, because the problem with doing it the way I did it is that you have to rebuild your init RAM disk each time you update your kernel, which means that it can't then be delivered in a signed form. But because Ubuntu are doing that and delivering it as a whole image, then it can be signed and it can be verified at boot time. So that's another interesting piece of this puzzle in ensuring the boot process is secure.
We also had a tremendous amount of feedback after the backup bonanza episode that we did a few episodes ago, which Joe rightly predicted the case that it would be the one with the most feedback. And Joe, you were right. Manny emailed in and said it was interesting to hear the Borg was quicker than our snapshot in my use case. And they said, I've used Vorta as a way to migrate data from Mac to Linux, which is interesting as a way to like back up on one system and then restore on another. And I hadn't thought about that, but actually I have used that with Borg. I've mounted, using the Borg mount command, mounted the backup of a different machine so that I could pull files out. So that I found very useful. But they went on to ask, has anyone had experience with the built-in CUP, that's K-U-P, or BUP, B-U-P? Have either of you heard of those or tried them?
I have not.
I know that they're the Kubuntu tools, but I've never used them.
Are they the tools that are for Borg, or are they like Vorta is for Borg, or are they some other like built-in backup tool?
I don't know.
No. It's weird how I can be using this for ages and I'd never even heard of these things before this email.
So you're talking there about you using Borg. When we recorded the episode, you were using our snapshot. So I think the unsaid rule here is something's changed.
Actually, the day after we recorded that episode, I switched from our snapshot to Borg. So now I'm using Borg on everything. Yes. Yes. Your influence over me, Martin, has worked. Patrick also emailed in, and they were interested in the fact that we were talking about backing up family photos. I think it was Mark who talked about that. And Patrick says, they sound pretty complicated. And since they rely heavily on servers that you manage, don't you run the risk of your family being losing all of their most precious data in the event of an untimely death? Oh dear, a bit dark, but yes. They'd love to hear what your spouses would be able to get out of your backups.
So in terms of photo syncing to Nextcloud, my partner also does have an account on our Nextcloud and can access, it's a shared volume that it backs up to. But yes, it's a fair point that it is a server that I built and manage and administer, and I don't think that she'd be too keen on trying to do that herself. And it's something that, you know, we've considered discussing on the show, but for various reasons have decided not to, and something that I do have in mind that perhaps I need some sort of backup plan for my backup recovery in the event that I'm not around to do it.
Yeah, that's a thorny point. And similarly to you, although I'm using Borg to do backups, they're like the tertiary backup. The main backups actually happen via Dropbox and sync thing, which my family do know how to operate and get all of the data and what have you. But like you, I do need to figure out how they get easy access and can look after, like in the event of my untimely demise, the data that is backed up via other means. But that's not how they access the data. That's like the insurance backup.
I know we don't want to talk about that for long, convoluted reasons, but I did talk to someone at work about this. There was a new starter and we had a one-to-one introducing them to the company. And for some reason, we got onto this topic and they were telling me that they've got this thing they call a green box, and it is just a bright green box, so it's easy to spot. And that's their box full of information. And yeah, they could put it somewhere safe and secure, but they've written stuff down and put it in there. And I think that's probably about as good as you can get with all the details of how to deal with it.
Yeah.
Jean emailed in and said, how do you deal with photos that are intentionally deleted from the phone? Do you have to delete them in both places?
Yeah. So, I mean, it depends on whether you manage to delete them before they get synced. But the way that we handle our photos is we sync everything up to Nextcloud, and then sort of monthly we go through and decide which ones we actually want to keep and organize them. And then anything else gets deleted. So yeah, we'd have to delete the copy off our phones. But at that point we can then see the folder from that month and say, has this been considered? Yes. And then the backups that are syncing to the cloud, at some point I can go through and say, oh, I know everything in the last 6 months has been sifted through, and I can delete the auto sync folder for that from the backup as well.
Got it.
I'm on strict orders. Photos cannot be lost. So our photos get synced over Dropbox, sync thing, and iCloud.
Mohammed emailed and said, I considered Borg backup previously, but it didn't seem noob friendly. Well, given I'd never heard of it before Martin told us about it, and I used it the next day, and I've converted every single machine. I converted most of them within about 24 hours. And I was a noob to Borg. And honestly, I installed it and then ran a couple of commands, and then I found a shell script, and that was it. And I just run that same shell script on every machine, and I just have cron jobs that are running at different times. I've learned a bit as I go, but it's really not that hard. It's not uber noob friendly, for sure. You do need to have some smarts, but it's not that hard. Lazarus sent us an email saying they wondered about a comment we made about sync thing. Apparently we mentioned that deleting a file causes the file to be deleted across your sync thing folders. Have you not dabbled with the versioning system in sync thing? They ask.
Yeah, so this was me. I'm familiar with the fact that you can have versioning in sync thing, but I have turned it off because I'm using Borg as my safety net. And I didn't want to account for another bit of buffer bloat with another thing keeping backups and versions. And most importantly, while SyncThing can keep those versions, working with those as a point of recovery is really cumbersome and awkward to do. So I've just decided to step it away and not deal with it and use something that's designed to do backups as my solution, which is Borg.
We got a fun email from Emil that says, my backup strategy for photos is quite simple. Paper. And they talk about, you know, printing them out. And paper is also quite easy to use. No need for elaborate setups or prepare for if or when I'm hit by a bus. This is all very true. Mm-hmm. This is all very true. So thanks for all the emails and other contact with us about backups. I hope we get more of that because it was all very interesting.
The conversation we had about Martin's music streaming service prompted an email from Jonathan saying, I found a great web service to import your playlists from one service to another.
Yeah, so they talk about a thing called Soundliz, and they were saying that it can split up their playlists into songs of up to 200 tracks at a time. Mm-hmm. When we recorded that podcast about me switching from Spotify to Apple Music, I hadn't actually handled the migration of playlists, which I have since done. And the tool I use to do that is an app for iOS called SongShift, and it is magical and marvelous in every conceivable way. Only my daughter and I had playlists. The largest ones had up to about 165 songs, and it moved everything over automatically, and it was just great. So I highly recommend that.
So is it a case of you log into both your accounts on both services and it says, oh, that song is that song, and does it?
Yeah, exactly that. It basically figures out what song is which on both sides. And occasionally it says, I couldn't find this. And if you just do like a manual resolve it, you can find the correct thing. Yeah. So it worked really well. And my daughter was very happy to have her playlist. She was very grumpy about hearing we were being moved after she'd curated her own playlists.
I have to say, my biggest gripe about using Plex and previously MB for my music streaming locally is the support for creating playlists for your own songs is absolutely dire.
Do you have to create your own M3U files and spread them around?
I wouldn't mind that, but it doesn't even support that. You've got to go through and like find each song one at a time and say, add this to this playlist. And it's a real ball ache.
I've got news for you, Mark. You can import PLS and M3U files into Plex. Maybe that's a topic for a future episode. And just to sort of round out my migration to Apple Music, I talked about this app called Cider, which is an Apple Music client for the desktop. It's Windows, Linux and Mac. And we did have some feedback at that time that version one of Cider was now considered out of support. It was sort of important bug fixes only. Well, just a couple of days ago, I purchased Cider 2, the new version, from itch.io. It cost me £3.50. It was available as a deb or an app image or an RPM or a package build. So I'm using the app image, and it is better than the classic version in every possible way. So I'm now a fully paid up Cider user, and I highly rate it. It's excellent.
We also had a bunch of feedback after the numerous mentions of Zero Tier on the show. Yuri said, thank you for covering Zero Tier on your podcast. However, I noticed several big mistakes in your coverage. Uh-oh.
Yeah, I think in an effort to sort of make that presentation of Zero Tier simple, I likened it to Tailscale, and that was probably a mistake because they are different. And we also got some feedback via Mastodon from Yannick saying that they just simply didn't understand what Zero Tier was. So I'm not going to cover it all again, but maybe to clarify things, you can say that Zero Tier is like a virtual layer 2 switch. So if you're a networking nerd, then you'll know what that means. And it just so happens that it then creates a mesh VPN between each of the clients on a given network. And it's great because it's a layer 2 network. It means that all network discovery protocols work, which means I can like access the printer from the other office at home and stuff like that.
So if you're a network nerd and you understand what a layer 2 switch is, that's fine. What if you're Yannick who doesn't understand?
It basically just extends your LAN to anywhere you are. So I'm going to talk about this in a future episode some more because I've done some more things with Zero Tier since. And I think that will help sort of clarify why Zero Tier is a superpower you really want.
Is a simpler way of saying it is it's like all of your computers are plugged into the same box.
Yeah, it's like all of your computers are on the same Wi-Fi network wherever they are in the world.
Yeah, or you've got a very long cable trailing out the back of your car and it's plugged in at home.
Yeah. So a couple of things to look forward to in the future is I've added a Zero Tier router to my home LAN, and I'm going to explain why that is a new kind of amazing. And I also wrote a blog post about installing Zero Tier on the Steam Deck, which I think you've done as well, Alan.
I have. And I also linked to that guide in the last show, episode 12. You can find it in the show notes for that one.
Well, Martin hasn't shoehorned a mention of NixOS into this episode yet, so I think we'd better go through some of the feedback we've had about that. Lyndon emailed, regarding the Call Martin for Support system updates problem, I think Nix's auto upgrades should be sufficient, shouldn't they?
The answer to that question is probably. So they sent me a fragment of a NixOS configuration to turn on auto upgrades. The only thing is I haven't had the time to research if the auto upgrade mechanism supports Nix Flakes or not. So watch this space. I will report back on that once I've figured it all out. But thanks, Lyndon, for the steer in the right direction.
Kyle emailed to say they love the idea of NixOS, but they can't get printing discovery to work like it does in Kubuntu.
Aha. Well, you're speaking to the right person. I used to work with the leading expert on Linux printing. I'll have some links in the show notes to fragments of my Nix configuration that explain how to do this. But for anyone listening along, you basically need to enable two services. One is for CUPS, which is the printing service, and the other is for Avahi with MDNS enabled. And with those two services running, printing discovery works, including, as I was saying earlier, over zero tier from remote locations.
Well, it's been great to go over everyone's feedback. Keep it coming in, everyone, and I think we should probably do this again at some point in the future.